Well, thank you very much for the welcome, Professor Marshall. And I think when I agreed to give this talk, I hadn't realized that much of the past month would be occupied with moving west, which is what I've been doing. But I don't think I'm allowed to change the title. And a good deal of my life until then has been concerned exactly with this question of the church moving south, to put it very, very shortly. I don't think I'll surprise many people if I begin with a reference to the Edinburgh 1910 World Missionary Conference and its flagship Commission 1, which was entitled Carrying the Gospel to All the Non-Christian World. And it was based on apparently quite a simple binary concept that there was a Christian world which had been fully evangelized, and there was a non-Christian world which was bereft of the gospel. And these two worlds, in simple terms, were geographically understood. Europe and North America was the Christian world, while Asia and Africa formed the non-Christian world. And it was agreed not to discuss areas like Latin America, which didn't fit neatly into this binary division. On this conception, the project of missionary endeavor was essentially very simple: carrying the gospel from areas where it was well established to areas where it was unknown. Beyond the wildest imagination of the Edinburgh delegates was the possibility that within 100 years, the geography of Christianity could turn by almost 180 degrees. As Andrew Walls has put it, by a huge reversal of the position in 1910, the majority of Christians now live in Africa, Asia, Latin America, or the Pacific. And the proportion is rising. Simultaneously with the retreat from Christianity in the West in the 20th century went, just as the visionaries of Edinburgh hoped, a massive accession to the Christian faith in the non-Western world. The map of the Christian church, its demographic and cultural makeup, changed more dramatically during the 20th century than probably any other since the first. The stark geographical framework which guided the 1910 conference is clearly not serviceable today. However, it is abundantly clear that there has been a recession in Christianity in the West, while the faith has spread prodigiously in the great continents of the South. As Philip Jenkins observed, the era of Western Christianity has passed within our lifetimes, and the day of Southern Christianity is dawning. The fact of change itself is undeniable. It has happened, and it will continue to happen. While undoubtedly there are formidable challenges facing the young churches of the South, there's no mistaking the fact that they demonstrate a vitality and a confidence almost completely absent in the historic churches of Europe. No wonder that the missionary and ecumenical leader Leslie Newbegin liked to quote General Sima Tupong of Indonesia. Of course, the number one question is, can the West be converted? Further question today might be what part, if any, the Christian faith of the South would play as an agent of such conversion. There's growing talk today of what's sometimes called mission in reverse. That is, to use the Edinburgh 1910 language, the gospel being carried from the South to the west. Now, Edinburgh 1910's Commission 1, chaired by the conference chairman John R. Mott, charged a subcommittee of its members, convened by James S. Dennis, to prepare a statistical atlas of Christian missions, which was published as an appendix to the report of the commission. And it's this volume which prompted the effort to produce a new atlas for the centenary of the conference. Here it is. And I'm very pleased to see Rose, one of the contributors, sitting modestly in the back row. Amongst many others, Rose and I have been involved in the production of this atlas, and I'm going to make some reference to it in the next part of the lecture. The 1910 Statistical Atlas aimed to present a comprehensive picture of the progress of Christian mission worldwide as things stood in the year 1910. And this new atlas has the same ambition 100 years later. Of course, there are important changes to be taken into account. And perhaps the biggest change is that it's no longer a matter of red dots marking the European and American mission stations in other parts of the world. We actually have reproduced on the inside cover what I think was the most famous map of 1910, with the little red dots showing the outposts of Christian mission across Africa and Asia. Do come and have a closer look in the tea break if you like. The methodology which created this atlas was to take the statistics of the World Christian Database, compiled and tested over many years by David Barrett, Todd Johnson and their team, and to project the statistics onto maps. And the statistics are based both on government census figures and on the membership records of churches, and continually working every day to try to get more accuracy in enumerating Christian profession. So, drawing on those statistics, the atlas offers a variety of tables, charts, and graphs to indicate key trends. But of course, being an atlas, its main offering is the maps. And by using shades of colour, it demonstrates the relative strength of affiliation to religion in a given geographical area. Here's the thing. we see here the situation. If you look for majority religion by country in 1910, and then we compare with the situation in 2010. And one of the key differences is it's not looking here only at country, but it's looking also at provincial level of analysis. Because especially in large countries like India or China, you can have a great deal of provincial variation. So I don't think it will surprise anybody here that the principal finding of the atlas is that whereas in 1910 Christianity was a religion concentrated largely in Europe and the Americas, with much of the rest of the world being regarded as a mission field, by 2010 it is strikingly evident that Christianity enjoys widespread allegiance and has become a dynamic force in much of Africa and in parts of Asia. So here's the concentration of Christians by country in 1910. And so you can see quite heavy representation in Europe and the Americas, in Australia, a little bit in the south of Africa, a little bit in the north and the Horn, a little bit in Western Asia, but otherwise very little representation of Christianity in the African and Asian continents. And then when we look at the situation in 2010, we can see quite a significant difference. Probably the thing that would stand out most if we look between the two would be the change in the sub-Saharan African region. But when you look more closely, you can see some significant changes in other areas as well. So throughout the atlas, each 2010 map is accompanied by an inset which shows the situation obtaining in 1910. So if we take a closer look at Africa, to come to the continental level and look at the continent which has undergone the greatest change, this was the situation by country in 1910, and here we have the situation in 2010. And remember the shading, the density of the shading shows the relative strength of Christians as a proportion of the total population. And I won't go through all the various devices that there are in the atlas, but let me just introduce you to one of them, which again in the case of Africa shows the extent of the change. This is what we call the tower, where each square in the tower represents 1% of the population. And so you can see really the same information, but in a different form, that in 1910 the majority of the African population are ethno-religionists following African traditional religion, significant proportion of Muslims, very small proportion of Christians, less than 10%. And the situation in 2010, we can see almost an equal balance between Christians and Muslims, with ethno-religionists having become rather few. Total number of Christians in Africa in 1910 was just under 12 million, 9.4% of the population. By 2010, the total has risen to almost 500 million, or 47.9% of the population. And we can go also to another level, looking beyond continent to the regional level. The atlas examines each of the 23 United Nations regions of the world. And I'll just take one which is particularly vivid. This is the UN region of Middle Africa, which is the Democratic Republic of Congo and the countries around it. And the situation in 1910, very thin representation of Christianity and almost entirely towards the coast. By 2010, one of the most dense areas of Christian profession in the world. So Africa certainly stands out very vividly in terms of church growth in the course of a century. Perhaps what's less expected is the extent of the growth of Christianity in Asia. Though it is true that Christians even today form a small minority of the total population of Asia, in the course of 100 years, their growth in numbers has been very significant. The total number of Christians in Asia in 1910 was just over 25 million, or 2.4% of the population, while in 2010 it is just over 350 million, or 8.5% of the population. And we can see it here in the tower. The tower for Asia is the most colourful one because it has the most different religions represented. Of course, Islam, Hinduism, heavily subscribed Chinese folk religions with many adherents in 1910, rather less in 2010. And then the little blue band representing the Christians, still a slender slice of the total, but when you compare the two, you have to recognize a very significant growth. And when you remember that this is the continent where most of the world's people live, the significance of this is not to be underestimated. One device used by the Atlas to trace demographic change, not an uncontroversial one, is what is called the statistical center of gravity of a religion in a particular year. This is the geographical point at which an equal number of believers in a given religion live to the north, the south, the east, and the west of that point. Taking you back to the provincial world map for the year 2010, if you see the two red dots, you can see how the center of gravity of Christianity as a religion has shifted from a point in southwest Spain in 1910 to a point near Timbuktu in 2010. So in the course of the century, it has moved in a decidedly southern and slightly eastern direction. So for the title of the talk, The Church Moves South, this is probably the slide to say it. And of course, what it demonstrates is the shift in preponderance of adherence to Christianity from Europe and North America to Africa, Asia, and Latin America. The comparative use of the center of gravity can also be quite revealing in relation to particular parts of the world. Look at Asia, for example. And you can see that for Christianity in Asia in the year 1910, the center of gravity was in Bengal, somewhere near Calcutta. By 2010, the center of gravity has moved to a point in southern China, just north of Vietnam. And what this vividly demonstrates is, as I'll say in a moment, that there has in fact been a decline in Christianity in the western part of Asia. But if you look at the eastern seaboard, you can see where very significant growth has occurred. So pulling the center of gravity in an eastward direction. Now, while in global terms, yes, I think we can say the story of Christianity is one of becoming more southern and eastern, the pattern is not uniform, and I wouldn't like to give the impression, as maybe some of the 1910 predecessors did, that it had been a kind of triumphant and advance everywhere. And in fact, Western Asia stands out as an area where we have to recognize significant Christian decline. So you can see both in 1910 and in 2010. So I think I've lost a little bit of the heading, but of course the left-hand column is 1910. Certainly a majority Muslim, but a substantial Christian minority, 22.9% in 1910. The story in 2010 down to just 5.7%. And in the commentary, Anthony O'Mahony observes that for Christianity in the Middle East, the last 100 years has witnessed a profound series of crises, displacement by war, genocide and interreligious conflict, leading to loss, emigration and exile, has been the main experience of Christianity in the Middle East. So it's not a uniform pattern, and one of the things with which the Atlas allows us to do is to look closely at different regions and make these kind of comparisons. But the overall picture is very clear that while there are clearly large parts of the world where Christianity remains a minority faith, its growth in the course of the century in the global south has been very significant. Europe is quite interesting because in terms of demography, the Atlas shows only a slight decline in adherence to Christianity in Europe. But of course, the demography works on the basis of self-identification. And the fact is that most Europeans still identify themselves as Christians. I think even here in Scotland, in the last government census, it was quite a large majority who, when they're asked to say what they are in terms of religion, that the answer they will give is Christian. But what demography cannot assess is how far this reflects perhaps a sense of cultural memory rather than an actively practiced faith. So another resource that we have in the Atlas is every 2 pages that has a map on it is accompanied by another 2 pages with an essay which gives analysis and interpretation. The one on Western Europe is by the Dutch sociologist André Drugers, who makes this comment that within a century, the churches in Western European countries have been moved from a central position to the margins of society. A small flock has difficulty in maintaining the infrastructure of the church, including buildings and clergy. In all churches, the leadership has to reformulate the church's task in the current constellation. Since many of the standard practices reflect a situation that no longer exists, the language of liturgy, hymn book and sermon is often that of previous centuries, incomprehensible to modern persons. So expansion in the global south has run in parallel to recession in the global north. Setting the past 100 years in the context of Christianity across 20 centuries in the Atlas, he says that once more the pattern of Christian advance appears as serial rather than progressive, withering at the center, blossoming at the edges. The great event in the religious history of the 20th century was the transformation of the demographic and cultural composition of Christianity brought about by the simultaneous processes of advance and recession. Daniel Jayaraj, in another quite comprehensive essay, makes the point that as a result of the demographic changes of the past century, Christianity is now the most pluralistic living religion, because at any given time, people worship Jesus Christ in the greatest number of languages, reflecting the diverse contexts in which Christian faith finds expression. So the demography makes it very clear that the church has moved south in the course of the century. So if my title had only been the church moves south, I could have sat down now and had a cup of tea, but unfortunately the organisers put in two other words about implication and elucidation, or was it the other way around? So we do need to go a bit further. What are the implications of this great demographic change for Christianity worldwide? A comment that is made again and again in the Atlas concerns the diversity which now marks worldwide Christianity. While it may be a world religion or a global religion, Christianity today is anything but uniform. As Dana Robert has observed, what at first glance appears to be the largest world religion is in fact the ultimate local religion. Indigenous words for God and ancient forms of spirituality have all become part of Christianity. Flexibility at the local level, combined with being part of an international network, is a major factor in Christianity's self-understanding and success today. The strength of world Christianity, she says, lies in its creative interweaving of the warp of a world religion with the woof of its local contexts. And the great change within our lifetime has been the unprecedented increase in the range and variety of these local contexts. You can see this if you ask the question, in what language is Christian faith being expressed? Spanish replaced English as the mother tongue of the greatest number of Christians around the year 1980. And today, Christian faith is being expressed in a growing diversity of languages. Brian Harmelink, in his Atlas essay, reports that in 2010, the total number of languages which have at least some Bible translation will surpass 2,500. And in a more analytical comment, Lamin Sani writes that the worldwide nature of Christian faith and practice is fixed in the multiplicity of languages employed in translation and worship, and that linguistic activity reached one of its high points in the 20th century to stamp the religion with its peculiar indigenizing character. Whatever the situation with regard to the core of the religion, there can be little doubt that it has never been about a universal linguistic or territorial core. The local idiom, not the language of social scale, is the original language of Christianity. As it recovers its rootedness in local idiom, Christianity's theological development will be informed by experiences and concepts which emerge in a variety of linguistic contexts, and require effective translation into international languages if they are to enrich the understanding of the church as a whole. The work of Western missionaries over the past two centuries has often been caricatured as a matter of domineering Westerners imposing their system of thought on hapless natives. The diversity of local character now becoming apparent in Christianity worldwide shows that the reality was very different. As Dana Robert has pointed out, in retrospect, it is evident that even during the colonial period, indigenous Christians, Bible women, evangelists, catechists, and prophets were all along the most effective interpreters of Christianity to their own people. The explosion of non-Western Christianity was possible because Christianity was already being indigenized before the colonizers departed. Ultimately, the most interesting lessons from the missionary outreach during the Western colonial era is what happened to Christianity when the missionaries weren't looking and after the colonizers withdrew. This widespread indigenizing of the faith makes the task of assessing global Christianity much more intricate and complex than would be the case if uniformity had been the prevailing trend. The demographic change in the course of a century would be dramatic enough if it were simply a matter of the Christian movement extending its home base and continuing to operate on exactly the same basis. In fact, it goes much further. It presages new forms of Christianity and new forms of missionary engagement. Philip Jenkins, in his celebrated book, makes the point that Southern Christianity, the Third Church, is not just a transplanted version of the familiar religion of the older Christian states. The new Christendom is no mirror image of the old. It's a truly new and developing entity. Just how different from its predecessor remains to be seen. Some helpful initial assessment is offered by three commentators. Philip Vickery, coming from long experience of Chinese church life, observes that the most dynamic sections of Christianity today are in movements emerging outside its established centres. The African-initiated churches, Pentecostals all over the world, the rural churches of China, new indigenous Christian communities throughout Asia, Africa, and Latin America. They represent a popular Christianity, a mission from below, a mission of transformation. Their emphasis is on oral tradition, lay leadership, and maximized participation, confronting historic Protestant churches with our carefully scripted, over-clericalized approaches to church life. Secondly, with a primary reference to the situation in Africa, Lamine Sané comments that in the turn it took in its post-Western phase, charismatic religion was more than a spacey rhapsodic binge, just as its effects went far beyond wild spectacles and heady excitement. The West insisted that worship must be of a God who was intellectualizable, because intellectual veracity was the safeguard against mystification and superstition. Yet for Africans, the call for explanation was not equal in its drawing power to the appeal of the living God, before whose eternal mystery explanation must exhaust itself in worship. Only the reality of a transformed spiritual life could commune with God, which in part was the need that the African charismatic movement existed to meet. The religious experience is about intimacy, connection, trust, discovery, and an ethical life in community and solidarity. Thirdly, Jehu Hanselas, considering primarily the faith of migrant Christians coming from the global south to the west, draws the contrast that the old heartlands exemplified political domination, territorial control, national religion, cultural superiority, and a fixed universal vision. In sharp contrast, the emerging heartlands of the faith embody vulnerability and risk, religious plurality, immense diversity of Christian experience and expression, and structures of dependency. So it's not only the demography, but with it many aspects of the profile of global Christianity, which are rapidly changing. And all of this brings us to what Andrew Walls, with his eye ever for the epigram, described as the Ephesian moment. That is, we have entered a time when, like never before, we have the opportunity to bring to fruition the vision set out in Ephesians 2, verse 22. In union with Christ, you two are being built together with all the others to a place where God lives through his Spirit. You are being built together with all the others. The possibility is there today to engage not across two major cultures, as in New Testament times and reflected in the letter to the Ephesians, but across a great many cultures. The potential is there for a great enriching of the faith, but it will not happen automatically. As Walls counsels, the demographic transformation of the church brought about by the missionary movement opens the possibility of testing our Christian witness by that of others, of experiencing one another's gifts and sharing our combined resources. Equally, it opens the prospect of a score of local Christianities operating independently, without interest or concern in one another. And he says either of these processes is possible. Only one of them reflects the New Testament view of the church or the Spirit of Christ. Perhaps there lies the great ecumenical challenge of this century. As we consider how best to meet it, let me just put a spotlight on three or four of the prominent changes which are taking place through the southward shift in the Christian faith. And let me talk first about missionaries. Another change clearly demonstrated in the Atlas is that the pattern of from the west to the rest missionary sending has given way to a movement which is from everywhere to everyone. Even when the definition of a missionary is restricted to someone who crosses national borders in the interests of propagating the faith, there's been a dramatic change in missionary sending since 1910. Approximately 62,000 missionaries were in service in 1910, while in 2010 the number has increased to some 400,000. Of the 62,000 missionaries in 1910, all but 1,400 were sent from global north countries. Of the 400,000 in 2010, 20,700 are sent from African countries, 47,100 from Asian countries, and 58,400 from Latin American countries. The 132,800 from Europe and 135,000 from North America ensure that still today the majority of missionaries originate in the global north. However, the proportion coming from the global south has increased exponentially and continues to do so. Africa, claims Tokumbo Adeyemo, has made the transition from mission field to missionary force. The indications are that the numbers of European and North American missionaries are declining, while their counterparts from the global south are increasing in number. And this shift in the pattern of missionary sending and receiving is even more marked if we take account of the many individuals who fulfill a missionary vocation within the borders of their own nation. Though such missionaries do not undertake the kind of lengthy sea voyages of their European and American predecessors a century earlier, they may well undertake no less arduous journeys in terms of adjusting to a new environment, a new culture, a new language, and so on. A century ago, observes Dana Robert, India and China had the largest foreign missionary presence, with foreign defined mostly as European. Today, their governments keep out foreign missionaries through visa restrictions. But within their borders, tens of thousands of home missionaries evangelize other ethnic groups. A century after Edinburgh 1910, missionaries are more diverse than in any previous era of human history. Certainly, in the popular mind, and perhaps to some extent in reality, missionaries of the Edinburgh 1910 era were working in some degree of complicity with colonialism and imperialism. As Jehu Hansilas observes, while the conversion of non-European peoples to the Christian faith was taken quite seriously, missionary action became fettered to political aggression and economic exploitation. And while European missionaries often made extraordinary sacrifices in their efforts to preach the gospel in distant lands, the missionary project was blighted by nationalist competition and ingrained attitudes of cultural and racial superiority toward non-European peoples. This complicity of Christian mission with Western imperial power sealed its foreign character and made it unappealing as a faith option, particularly in Asia. By contrast, today's missionaries are ever more likely to share a similar racial, cultural, and economic background to the people among whom they serve. Lal Sangkhima Pakhao gives the example of a Korean missionary in Thailand. And he says, "We are easily accepted as one of their own, and we on our part understand better their situation and ways of thinking." To put this in historical perspective, Pakhao remarks, if the 1910 World Missionary Conference in Edinburgh represents the high point of the modern missionary movement from the West to Asia, Edinburgh 2010 marks another high point, namely Christian missions from Asia, by Asians, in Asia, and around the world. A similar pattern is observable in regard to Latin America, as Marcelo Vargas and Antonia Leonera van der Meer have observed. The first decades of missionary experience, of missionary work on the continent, relied heavily on the hundreds of devoted North American and European missionaries who dedicated their lives sacrificially for the sake of the gospel. Today, foreign personnel are still active, but not indispensable to the missionary task. What makes mission occur today are the thousands of local and national partners working every day as missionaries, not only within their own continent, but also all over the world. The next section is something of a corollary to this new agency of mission, and it is the increasing reality that mission is carried out by the poor. Of course, the earlier missionary movement represented by Edinburgh 1910 was no stranger to vulnerability and relative poverty. But we do have to acknowledge that, by and large, it was a movement resourced and funded by relatively prosperous societies, which undertook its work in much less economically developed societies. Hence, a close interconnection was formed between mission and what was then called civilization, what we might now call development. One of the sharpest critiques of the Western missionary movement was published by the Anglican missionary Roland Allen almost 100 years ago. And in his book entitled Missionary Methods, St. Paul's or Ours, he contrasted the Pauline mission, which was powerless in worldly terms and therefore dependent on the Holy Spirit, with what he saw as the alliance of the modern missionary movement with the power of the Western world. Well, if Roland Allen were alive today, he might be surprised to see that the identification of Christianity with the powerful is increasingly a thing of the past. More and more, the agents of Christian mission come from among the weak, the broken, and the vulnerable. It's a new kind of agency. But is it not one which has greater affinity to Paul and to Jesus than the form of missionary presence, which often appeared to be allied to imperial power and economic exploitation? Increasingly, we see a situation emerging quite opposite to the one which troubled Roland Allen. Swept by unmerciful currents of history, Christian believers bear witness to the suffering Lord, in whom they find the strength to meet adversity. A new or recovered pattern of missionary activity is emerging, in which the poor take the gospel to the rich. Hans Selous has observed that this non-Western missionary movement represents mission beyond Christendom, mission delinked from structures of power and domination, mission undertaken from positions of vulnerability and need, mission freed from the bane of territoriality and one-directional expansion from a fixed centre. Mission involving agents who reflect the New Testament reference to the weak things of the world. 1 Corinthians 1, verse 27. The organisational pattern also starts to look quite different from that which prevailed in the Western missionary movement. There's no mistaking the fact that the gospel is spreading through migratory movements, but there's no sign of anything like a missionary society. There's no head office, no organizing committee, no command structure, no centralized fund, no comprehensive strategic direction. It appears to be a disorganized movement of individuals making their own connections, developing their own perspectives, and functioning within networks which they themselves have constructed. It's been characterized as a liquid movement, lacking in solid structures. Those accustomed to living with vulnerability have little to lose and are often ready to take risks and be open to others in a way which would not come easily to those who are accustomed to positions of power and privilege. They also have the motivation which could easily elude their more comfortable fellow Christians to work with God for transformation. They're sensitive to the death-dealing forces, structures, and systems which threaten human flourishing. Their prayer for the kingdom of God to come has a depth and a potency which is rarely found amongst the prosperous. The poor, therefore, have a leading role in the mission of God in the world today. As Samuel Escobar has put it, there is an element of mystery when the dynamism of mission does not come from the people in a position of power or privilege, but from below, from the little ones, from those who have few material, financial, or technical resources. Hans Selous draws a contrast between the two eras of mission. Shaped by Christendom ideals, Western missions remained marked by an emphasis on distinctions and differences, territorial, cultural, and racial. Shaped by the experience of plurality and diversity, non-Western efforts are oriented towards relational presence and interpersonal exchange. How could the older missionary movement productively relate to the new pattern? What forms of connection and association will provide unity and synergy for such a diverse movement of faith? When Samuel Escobar came to give one of the lectures that we had in the run-up to the Edinburgh 1910 centenary, he gave us this challenge. The Holy Spirit seems to be at work, especially in the periphery of the world, giving Christian people a vision and mobilizing them for global and local mission, in spite of poverty, lack of experience, and absence of training. If this is the way the Spirit is moving, what needs to be done to walk in step with his reviving and transforming activity? What kinds of global partnerships have to be imagined and developed for this new stage of mission history? Let me turn now to something we alluded to briefly, the question of migration. There has, of course, for long years been close connection between migration and mission. People moving, whether voluntarily or involuntarily, to a new place, often take their faith with them. They plant congregations, which may initially be expatriate in their composition, but which, as they become established in their new environment, often have a missionary impact, which extends far beyond their original constituency. In the context of the early 21st century, it's strikingly apparent that there are large numbers of economic migrants and that the migration routes lead predominantly from the global south to the global north. This brings Christians from centres of renewal in the global south to the old heartlands where the fire of faith is often burning low. Hans Selous offers this assessment of the missionary impact of African migration He says, by the end of the 20th century, African migrants were widely dispersed among the wealthy industrialized countries of the north. And everywhere they went, they established new Christian congregations. In effect, African migrations have provided a vital stimulus for missionary expansion, for the simple reason that every Christian migrant is a potential missionary. In both Europe and North America, African immigrant congregations have grown in unprecedented fashion and represent the cutting edge of Christian growth. I remember a few years ago worshipping in a Zimbabwean congregation in Wester Hales, here in Edinburgh. And it was at a time when there was a major national crisis taking place in Zimbabwe. So when it came to the time for the intercessory prayers, I fully expected that there would be an outpouring of prayer for the homeland of the worshippers. Instead, there were a series of passionate prayers for the conversion of the people of Scotland. That was clearly the agenda. A group of worshippers very clear about the nature of their missionary vocation. Here were people who had taken to heart the injunction reported by Hanselas: don't be refugees, be missionaries. And Walter Hollenweger once made the wry observation that Christians in Britain prayed for many years for revival, and when it came, they didn't recognize it because it was black. This large-scale migratory movement has already brought a new dimension to church and mission in such centers of economic power as Europe, North America, or the Gulf States. In his Atlas essay, Jonathan Bonk observes that much contemporary evangelization is part of a vast migration, surpassing in scale and potential import the one that saw Europeans sweep the globe. A great majority of the migrants are deceptively inconsequential, profoundly Christian, and explicitly evangelistic. The effects of this are evident in many different parts of the world. Roswith Gerloff and Abraham Ako Akrong, again in an Atlas essay, refer to religions on the move amidst processes of transmigration and transculturation, which unleash dynamic, reciprocal, transitory, and multidimensional creations in shaping a polycontextual world. They conclude that the overall scene on all continents, including the migration of African, Asian, or Caribbean Christians to northern white-dominated societies, displays a reticulate structure. The vast variety and pluriformity of Christian families, including traditional elements which overlap denominationally, culturally, and linguistically. Current trends suggest that this mobilization of the masses in the South will be the driving force in Christian mission, with all promises and risks. At this point in history, when many of the migrants are first generation, it is observable that they often worship in their own language and function as very much a support group for one another as they navigate the transition into their host society. Their social and cultural milieu is distinctive and not normally given to easily engaging the cultural mainstream of the host society in a missionary way. Yes, they bring a vital Christian presence, but it can be one which has something of a ghetto character, limiting its missionary possibilities. A key question may be what transpires in the second and third generations, as greater assimilation takes place, will the passionate faith of the immigrant community weaken as it encounters the acids of modernity? Or will it strengthen as the community employs growing bicultural competency to connect at a spiritual level with the society in which it is set? The last thing I would like to take a glance at is the question of mission and business. For new mission dynamics are also emerging on what might be regarded as the opposite side of globalization to that represented by the poor. Several strong trends have coalesced to promote a reconfiguration of the relationship between business and mission. In the classic Western missionary paradigm, the role of business was to generate the income which could be used to support dedicated mission agencies. And many of the most effective missions drew their financial resources from the support of successful business people. The change of paradigm now being proposed is that the business people themselves might be the missionaries. In a post-colonial world, the missionary visa is increasingly a thing of the past. On the other hand, businesses which are willing to invest and offer employment are welcome in many contexts. In terms of mission strategy, this invites the creation of a new mission agent, described by Steve Rundle and Tom Steffen as the Great Commission Company. And as they explain, the purpose of a Great Commission Company is to bring good news in word and deed to the neediest parts of the world. The good news about globalization, they say, is that the barriers which once prevented them from hearing this message are falling, and the mission's baton is being handed to a new breed of messenger. At the same time as this new thinking emerges from the perspective of mission strategy, traditional approaches to development are coming under unprecedented critique. Both secular and religious agencies have worked for a generation on the premise that aid would provide a solution to underdevelopment in poor countries. This approach has recently been subject to some scorching critique, such as that offered by Dambisa Moyo in regard to Africa. Has the $1 trillion US dollars in development assistance over the last several decades made African people better off? No. In fact, across the globe, the recipients of this aid are worse off, much worse off. Aid has helped to make the poor poorer and growth slower. Aid has been and continues to be an unmitigated political, economic, and humanitarian disaster for most parts of the developing world. Moyo methodically makes her case that the cycle that chokes off desperately needed investment, instills a culture of dependency, and facilitates rampant and systematic corruption, all with deleterious consequences for growth, the cycle that in fact perpetuates underdevelopment and guarantees economic failure in the poorest aid-dependent countries. Well, inasmuch as mission work has been interconnected with development work in poor countries, it also is exposed to this kind of critique. And insofar as the promotion of the business model emerges as a better alternative to the distribution of aid, business as mission begins to look like an idea whose time has come. Indications are that the missionary outreach of the Asian and African churches, to which the initiative is increasingly passing, may give expression to this paradigm. Writing in the Atlas of Southeast Asia, Violet James observes that many missionaries are entering countries as tent makers. Indonesians, Filipinos, Malaysians, and Singaporeans are part of a large missionary force in Asia today as educators, doctors, nurses, business people, and consultants in information technology. Some business people have started various micro-enterprise projects to empower the poor. CMS Africa, a mission agency just weaned last year from its parent body, the Anglican Church Mission Society, has accepted the challenge that a lack of true discipleship within African churches is the key issue to address. And it aims to nurture faith, which will be culturally and socially transformative. Among the strategies being developed by CMS Africa is what they call BAM, Business as Mission. And as Sarah Wambua explains, business as mission is about establishing real businesses and not an excuse to enter into a community for evangelistic purposes. Business as mission is seen as the entry point for poverty reduction, and it is empowering and inspiring businessmen and women in Africa to create jobs and make wealth strategically dealing with the poverty challenge. Here is an African model of mission, departing from the binary understanding where secular business and Christian mission are two separate watertight compartments. Seeking at one and the same time authenticity in discipleship and economic transformation in African societies, it sees business as a mode of mission whose time has come. The vision is that a more holistic faith, working through business initiatives, will deepen discipleship while mobilizing people of faith to combat the acute poverty endemic still across the continent. Well, very different though it may be, the missionary movement driven from the south undoubtedly is invigorating Christian witness as we move into this 21st century. So, despite its various blind spots, weaknesses, and mistaken alliances, the 20th century witnessed a vindication of the fundamental conviction of the missionary movement, which arose from the evangelical revival. It is apparent today, like never before, that the good news of Jesus Christ can take root in every culture across the world and produce fruit in church and society everywhere. The worldwide flourishing of the faith stands as a demonstration of the validity of that vision, that the gospel could be received and could find expression in completely new contexts. Without that missionary movement, the prospects for Christianity as a world religion might well be doubtful today, particularly as its long-time European homeland is proving rather inhospitable. Largely as a result of the seeds planted by missionary endeavor, vigorous and numerous expressions of Christian faith are found on all six continents today. It has become the truly worldwide faith which theologically it always aspired to be. Beyond any question, this movement to the south has breathed huge new energy into the worldwide Christian movement. So much so that such is the diversity and dynamism of Southern Christianity that a significant risk could be fragmentation, discovering new expressions of coherence may be important for Christianity as a global faith going forward. Equally, developing fruitful synergy between old patterns and new might be key to deploying available resources to maximum effect in the interests of Christian mission. These are not small challenges, but they're faced in a context where the southward move of the church has ensured that the world Christian movement enters this new century with large numbers, great vitality, and fresh imagination.